Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause and keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the Donate tab. Howard Zinn writes, "To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we only see the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there were so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending the spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of present moments. And to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory." So this morning I'd like to talk about gratitude and sympathetic joy. This is the practice of taking delight in the goodness in our lives and also the joy and the happiness of other people's lives. I was reading this quote earlier today, and I was thinking about how often I try to remind myself of this thing that Howard Zinn says, if we only see the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. And as someone that's grown up with a very critical mind, a very skeptical mind, a very depressed mind, to be honest, I have a tendency to always see the worst in things. I have a hyper-aversion, distrust, cynicism, skepticism. And in the Buddhist context, this practice of mindfulness is in the service of helping us to have a wise view of things. And that's the first factor of the Buddha's Eightfold Path, is the wise view, to have a wise view. And it's also the culmination of the path. Sometimes the Eightfold Path is seen as a wheel, much more than a linear path. It's a path that is supporting itself. So as we develop ethics, as we develop living with our integrity, as we develop our minds and our hearts, we develop more wisdom. And in the Buddhist sense, the word wisdom here, samma, means something more like complete. So the wise view that we want to have is not the view that the Buddha gives us. It's not a special, secret, spiritual view. It's really a wise view in the terms of having a complete or accurate view of things. And so when we see the whole picture, not just the problems, right, but also the causes of our well-being, the goodness in our lives, we have more of a wise view. And a lot of times Buddhists kind of get a bad rep because we look so much at confronting what's getting in our way, craving and clinging, wanting things to be otherwise, and how that causes us stress, our reactivity, how that causes us stress, our resentments, our greed, our delusions, how that causes us stress. And we want to look at the causes and conditions of stress and suffering, but we also want to look at the causes and conditions of liberation, of freedom, of awakening. And so this is what I think it means to have a wise view, is to look at the whole picture. And sometimes we have to intentionally focus on what's good. And many of y'all know the kind of neuroscience research around the negativity bias, how we have a tendency to hyper-focus on the problem. And I like to tell people your mind is like a problem-solving machine, and if you don't have problems, it will make some for you. And when you come into Buddhist practice and you hear, let's look at suffering and the causes of suffering, your mind will say, happily, I will definitely look at all my suffering and the causes of suffering. But it's not actually the looking that the Buddha was talking about, which is actually the type that we get caught in, is the trance of our suffering, which is the activation, the rumination, the obsession, the how do I figure it out and fix it and get rid of it, which is just more craving and clinging. But the type of looking that the Buddha's offering is a type of slowing down, of developing some tranquility and some peace of mind so we can see more clearly as our mental habits arise, we can notice them. As our reactivity arises, we can notice it. And we can also incline ourselves to look more at the goodness in our lives and the causes and things that support us. If we see what we're doing right, it also motivates us to keep doing those things. So I think that there's a utility behind gratitude. If we focus on what's going well, I, at least for me, I feel like I'm motivated to continue to do the things that create that. And whether I like to admit it or not, I'm really easily motivated by positive reinforcement. And when I reflect on the things that I'm grateful for, the things that have brought me some success or joy in my life, it builds up a motivating energy. And there's some research behind this. One study, I'll just read the findings of this study, says feelings of gratitude directly activated brain regions associated with the neurotransmitter dopamine. Dopamine feels good to get, which is why it's generally considered the reward neurotransmitter. But dopamine is also important in initiating action. That means increases in dopamine make you more likely to do the thing you just did. It's the brain saying, oh, do that again. Gratitude can have such a powerful impact on your life because it engages your brain in a virtuous cycle. Your brain only has so much power to focus its attention. It cannot easily focus on both positive and negative stimuli. It's like a small child, easily distracted. Your brain also likes to fall for the confirmation bias. That is, it likes to look for things that prove what it already believes to be true. And the dopamine reinforces that as well. So this is the point. Once you start seeing things to be grateful for, your brain starts looking for more things to be grateful for. That's how the virtuous cycle gets created. So this is what Howard Zinn says when he says, if we remember those times and places, and there were so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending the spinning top of a world in a different direction. So I think a lot about, as a social worker, I'm in a lot of communities of people that are activists, and the key word in activism is active. And if we focus on things that burn us out, hopelessness, right? If we focus on too much of what's going wrong, we lose what he's talking about here, this energy to act. And that's beyond activism in the world. It's also action in our own lives. So the Buddha also saw the importance of gratitude, and he included it as an essential part of training our mind. And like I talked about last week, the mind in Buddhism is not just the cognitive mind, it's also emotional. And so training our heart and our mind to recognize gratitude, to know what that feels like, to try to cultivate, generate it. The Buddha called it one of the sublime states of mind. He also called it one of the immeasurables. He also called it a Brahma-vihara, which means divine abode, or when actually translated, it means the home of God. And it's kind of cool. In Buddhism, there's not so much emphasis on higher powers or God. They talk about gods in the suttas, but gods in the Buddhist sense also suffer. They're still caught in the cycle of samsara. And what this means to me is the Buddha is saying that don't try to find God, but live where God dwells. You can go to her or his or it or theirs house and live there. And where does God dwell? God dwells in gratitude and in loving kindness and in compassion and in equanimity. Those are the four Brahmaviharas, the four homes, like the four chambers of our heart. So I like to think about gratitude in the Buddhist sense in two different ways. One is gratitude as non-attached appreciation, and then gratitude as something called sympathetic joy. I'm going to talk a little bit about both of these. Non-attached appreciation is the practice of taking active delight in something without craving and clinging. Now, the key word here is practice. So as you hear me say the practice of taking active delight in something without craving or clinging, probably most of us would say that's impossible. And that's the point, right? Is we want to practice, what is it like to actually have a moment of enjoyment, a moment of pleasure? And then to notice when the extra stress of craving and clinging comes in to ruin it. You know, like when you're on vacation and it's so good, but you just want it to keep going and you stay up a little later or spend a little more money or plan another day or whatever it is to just prolong the experience. Then there's the stress of keeping it going. And this is a really ridiculous example. I debated whether I was going to share this, but I guess I'm going to. My wife and I like this type of popsicle that you can get at Kroger. And I'm trying not to eat like bowls of ice cream at night, so I got these like fresh fruit popsicles. And I started eating like three of these fucking things in a row, like every night. And to the point where it was like making my lips bleed. And I realized I actually wasn't enjoying the popsicle. I had had an experience where it tasted really good. I was just trying to keep that experience going, you know, which is a little ridiculous. But there's a story. It's actually a true story, and it's a little bit sad, especially for animal lovers. It's a true story. In India, they try to catch these monkeys that are all around, and I don't know if they eat them or just try to get them out of the city or whatever it is. So let your mind use the best scenario possible. But they try to catch them, and what they do is the monkeys are so greedy that all they have to do is bury a clay pot in the ground that has a hole just big enough to fit their hand when they put it like this, long ways. And they reach in the pot to get a piece of food, and they hold the food, and they try to pull their hand out of the pot. And they can't get their hand out of the pot unless they drop the food. And they'll just be sitting there with their hand in the pot as whoever's trying to capture them will come up, and they won't let it go. And they'll have to, like, dig up the pot to grab the monkey to take it out of the city so it lives a really great life. So what does it mean to have non-attached appreciation? To some degree, it's about our relationship to pleasure and looking at our strong attachment, wanting it to be more, wanting it to last longer. We have to recognize that in this practice of mindfulness, it's not about moralizing or harshness. It's not about thinking this craving and clinging is our fault. It's really a mechanism of our neurobiology that hijacks our happiness. And the Buddha just recognized this. He said, oh, this is interesting. The mind, when it has something it likes, it wants more and it holds on. And that causes us to suffer because these pleasant experiences are temporary. And we can enjoy them and have a way to enjoy them without holding on. Non-attached appreciation. So I like to look at this in a simple way of how can we learn to relax in joyful moments? So the next time you're eating with some friends or out at dinner or having popsicle or whatever it is, notice what actually happens inside, you know, in the body, in the mind, around that experience. And can you breathe, relax, and feel a different kind of enjoyment that doesn't require more? It doesn't require longer. And not to get too deep, but I'm kind of like recently been thinking about how any moment of enjoyment requires us to experience at least a mini moment of loss. And so there seems to be this kind of like non-duality component to joy, where our deepest capacity to feel the loss of something is our deepest capacity to feel real joy. And that kind of blows my mind a little bit when I think about it, because that means that if I can let myself enjoy something knowing that it's going to pass, I can find a type of enjoyment that's not conditional. It's something that is momentary and authentic, but also includes loss. So another flavor of non-attached appreciation is something we would just call gratitude. And gratitude is kind of a seeking, a recognition of things that you appreciate. So it's kind of a reflective practice or an intentional kind of contemplation. Gratitude's also an emotion, I feel like. I had someone recently offer for my wife and daughter and I to go on vacation with them. One of their family members couldn't go, and we have this all-paid vacation. We just had to buy our plane tickets for a week. And my wife and I don't think have ever been on a whole, other than our honeymoon, a week vacation together. So there was just this feeling of gratitude that this person had thought of us. It was more than the excitement of going on the trip. It was like, wow, someone like thought of us, and they don't really get anything out of it. They have to deal with us for a week. So gratitude is more of a reflective practice. It's also an emotion. It's kind of delighting in the goodness of our lives, whatever that symbolically means. Uplifting joy of having support or being cared for, or laughter, friendships, community, stuff like that. And I want to talk a little bit about this other aspect of gratitude, which is sympathetic joy. It's having joy for the happiness of other people. I like to break down sympathetic joy into defining the term. So sympathy means the act or capacity of entering into or sharing the feelings or interests of another. So I'll say it again. Sympathy means the act or capacity of entering into or sharing the feelings or interests of another. I was talking to someone recently that's not from the U.S., and it's a little bit judgmental, but I actually find it to be true. He said, you know, it kind of astounds me when I'm talking to Americans how much they like to talk about themselves. And he said, in where I'm from, he said, people are a lot more interested in sharing what you're interested in. So they'll kind of start by saying, like, what are you into? And asking you a bunch of questions until they find something that they share. And that's kind of the act of sympathy in a way. It's entering into sharing in feelings or interests of another. In this case, we're talking about sharing in joy. And joy is a peaceful or uplifting emotion that results when we feel connection and or delight. So how can we practice entering into and actively delighting in the joys and successes of others? The reason why the Buddha taught sympathetic joy is because it's an antidote to jealousy, which is such a difficult mind state to deal with. And the reason why jealousy for me is so hard to deal with is because it's a very complex emotion. It has both greed and hatred in it together. It is a desire for something we don't have mixed with a hatred for the one who possesses it. It's a desire for something we do have mixed with at least an aversion towards the one who has it. So it simultaneously produces a feeling of lacking or missing out, and also the feeling of resentment or the feeling of aversion. Shakespeare in Othello writes about this. He says, "Oh, beware, my lord, of jealousy. It is the green-eyed monster which mocks the meat it feeds on." And I like that. It mocks the meat it feeds on. Both having an aversive, negative, judgmental attitude towards someone for getting something, but also wanting that thing at the same time. And it's funny to me because when I look at what jealousy's kind of purpose is, it's a lot of our more primitive tendencies that I think don't really serve us as a species anymore, right? Like scarcity, not having enough. If you're doing good, I'm losing something. That's the feeling I think that underlies jealousy a lot of the time. Even if I don't want the thing that you're getting, which is crazy to me. And I tell people about an experience I had. I was working in an organization, and we were in a meeting in the morning, and they announced that someone got a promotion for a job that I would hate. And I remember being like, why does that person get the promotion? And just feeling like totally I was missing out on something that I didn't even want. And I had no sympathetic joy. But then I was stuck with this feeling of wanting something that I didn't even really want. And I think it's because of this kind of primal scarcity drive. Competition is another primal drive, I think, for us. Others' success means my loss of position in the tribe. I think a lot of the reasons why we compete is because we want position, we want power, we want status. And so when someone moves forward, we hate to admit it, but I think that there's this kind of animalistic part of us that says, I'm losing position. I'm losing status. They're gaining. And so, you know, but if we look at that more in a gentle way, I think it's about losing likability, you know, and our sense of belonging. Are we going to be forgotten? Are we going to be left behind? Are we less important? That's what a lot of our competition drive does. And this often manifests in also in comparison. So we look a lot at other people's success and make it a judgment about ourselves. So comparing is kind of the mechanism of competition a lot of the time. Your success means something about me. I see this a lot as cliche as it is to talk about with social media. And how much the comparing mind is just active on that thing. You know, we don't present a wise view. You know, we don't present the whole picture. Remember, wise in this sense means complete. You know, some people are pretty vulnerable on social media, but, you know, I don't think it's a possibility for us to really feel the whole person, right? To present the whole person. And so that's one experience that I really recognize it. And I know it's kind of the thing to shit talk social media or to, you know, whatever. I think it in and of itself is great. You know, you connect with people, but it's more of just looking at how we relate to it, you know, and how much does jealousy and envy ramp up around our use of it. In this jealousy and envy, and this theme of jealousy and envy, there's a really great quote by Jonathan Foyer, and he writes, "Sometimes I can hear my bones straining under the weight of all the lives I'm not living." So how do we practice it? There are so many ways, and the good news is that we already do. You know, we practice gratitude. We practice non-attached appreciation. We practice sympathetic joy and delighting in the joys and successes of others. And really what this practice, what the Buddha's path is all about, is being more intentional. So it's about really reflecting and taking the time to cultivate and develop gratitude actively. You know, if we don't do it, it doesn't really happen. You know, sometimes we get moments of gratitude when the conditions are right. But like I talked about last week, we have to create the conditions. So being of service, we talked about last week, is a really easy way to feel grateful, you know, and to have delight in the joys of other people. Also, I like to practice faking it till we make it, especially with those people that we have a hard time having joy towards, the difficult people. And you'll find that these aren't always the people that we think are our enemies. They're sometimes the people that are closest to us. And so, you know, I used to constantly invalidate other people when they got success or joy or things were happening in their lives. It's like I took the gold from underneath their rainbow. And I didn't mean to. It's just I couldn't be with. I don't know what it was, and it's really humbling to say, but I couldn't stand to actually be in the experience of them getting something sometimes. And so I would be dismissive or, you know, not acknowledge it. And I'm sure this comes from somewhere in my upbringing and family system and so on and so forth. But what I started practicing doing is just the first stage of sympathetic joy was just making eye contact, trying to hear and see in someone their delight. And I didn't even compliment or say anything. I just started by trying to look at people enjoying things. And there's this form of therapy that I do now that the whole start process of the therapy, it's called somatic experiencing, is about helping people to feel safe and to feel grounded before you start doing trauma work. And so you have to really work on hearing what is delighting people and focusing on it. And so you don't really tell people you're doing it, but the whole first part of the session, you're trying to get them to talk about what's good. And when they go to what's bad, you acknowledge it, and then you turn them back to what's good. And you spend the whole like first part of the session just kind of focusing on what's good. And well, what was really great about that interaction? Or what do you love about hanging out with your grandma? She sounds really great. It sounds like you had a good time. And you get them to describe it and talk about it. And so this kind of a practice of just being with delight and learning to have a different relationship to pleasure and joy. They say that in the traditional teachings, that or in the commentaries, I should say, on the traditional teachings, that a requisite for gratitude for others is gratitude for oneself. Because a lot of times our jealousy and envy comes from a place of scarcity. And if we have gratitude for ourselves, if we work on it, it's easier to have it for other people. And like I said, generosity, practicing the heart practices. You know, I like to alternate my meditation practice. Every other day I do, you know, basic kind of mindfulness or insight practice. And then I'll do one of the heart practices, metta practice or a gratitude practice for a month or a compassion practice for a month. And I just sit with those phrases like we did today and I just try to practice it. You know, because if we sit down, I think I talked about last week, it's like going to the gym. If you go into the gym and you lift a weight one time and you're like, oh, that didn't really work, I'm not stronger, that would be ridiculous. And we do that with meditation sometimes. It's like, I did the gratitude practice. I didn't really feel it. I don't think it works. It's like, what about a month of gratitude, you know, or every other day at least practicing it? So I want to read a quote to end, and then we can have some discussion together. This is about sympathetic joy, and I've read this several times. It's probably my favorite quote on the topic by Sam Harris, and it's from his book, Waking Up. He says, I was suddenly struck by the knowledge that I loved my friend. This shouldn't have surprised me. He was, after all, one of my best friends. However, at the age I was at, I was not in the habit of dwelling on how much I loved the men in my life. Now I could feel that I loved him, and this feeling had ethical implications that suddenly seemed as profound as they now sound pedestrian on the page. I wanted him to be happy. What did I care if my friend was better looking or a better athlete than I was? If I could have bestowed those gifts on him, I would have. Truly wanting him to be happy made his happiness my own. That conviction came crashing down with such force that something seemed to give way inside me. My capacity for envy, for instance, the sense of being diminished by the happiness or success of another person, seemed like a symptom of mental illness that had vanished without a trace. And then came the insight that irrevocably transformed my sense of how good human life could be. I was feeling boundless love for one of my best friends, and I suddenly realized that if a stranger walked through the door at that moment, he or she would have been fully included in this love. Love was at bottom impersonal and deeper than any personal history could justify. The insight had the character of a geometric proof. It was as if, having glimpsed the properties of one set of parallel lines, I suddenly understood what must be common to them all.